Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org. This program is recorded from an earlier live broadcast.
Live from the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking about oligarchy and how there is one here in America, and also it's on the ballot. But first, yesterday, Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump gave his closing argument to America in his bid to return to the White House. The Madison Square Garden rally was a stream of disinformation, racism, hate, and threats of violence. Trump doubled down on his promise for massive deportations on day one. And with us now on the line to talk about that is San Antonio Congressman Democrat Joaquin Castro to react to the event. And Congressman Castro, welcome back to The Source.
Good to be with you.
A lot of people are keying into, they call him a comic. I don't know if he is or if he isn't. I didn't find him funny at all. But this guy said a bunch of horrible things up there and about Puerto Rico and also other racist tropes about people of all types, except he didn't say anything about, I don't think he said anything about, he was very selective in who he picked out. So what's your reaction to all that?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very dark, very racist diatribe. And it wasn't just that one speaker. It was a lot of the different speakers who were very, very angry, very hostile, very divisive, and often targeting different vulnerable and minority communities. And so it really is like a frightening preview of what a Donald Trump administration would look like for him if he gets another term as president.
Yesterday on 60 Minutes, they looked at what a mass deportation program would actually look at, how it would be carried out, how much it would cost, who it would impact. And they talked to Tom Holman, who led ICE during the Trump administration. And Trump has indicated that Holman would be handpicked to lead the deportation program if Trump is reelected. And here's a clip from that 60 Minutes.
It would cost $88 billion to deport a million people a year.
I don't know if that's accurate or not.
Is that what American taxpayers should expect?
What price do you put on national security? Is it worth it?
Is there a way to carry out mass deportation without separating families?
Of course there is. Families can be deported together.
More than 4 million U.S.-born children live with an undocumented parent.
Why should a child who is an American citizen have to pack up and move to a country that they don't know?
Because their parent absolutely entered the country illegally, had a child knowing he was in the country illegally, so he created that crisis.
So Congressman Castro, you're talking about ending birthright citizenship for children who were born of undocumented folks, mass deportation of entire families, claiming that this is a national security issue when that's obviously ridiculous. Can you react to all that?
There have been at least two instances of mass deportation that have affected Hispanics in the United States, one around World War II and one around what was called Operation Wetback. And during that period, there were more than a million Latino Americans, in other words, American citizens, who were deported to Mexico. These were people that had every right to be in the country. And yet they were rounded up along with undocumented immigrants and sent to Mexico. So there is a real danger when you talk about mass deportation of not only devastating the lives of young kids who are going to be separated and torn from their mothers and fathers, but also of rounding up American citizens and sending them out of the country. Because what history has shown us is that there is a mass hysteria that takes over. And people stop asking the detailed questions of what and who and why and everything. And people get rounded up. And people with every right to be in the country will find themselves somewhere else.
But the mass deportation aspect of Donald Trump's campaign, it is a tentpole issue for him. So if it's such a threat to Mexican Americans in South Texas, anyone and everyone could be put on buses and dumped across on the other side of the Rio Grande. Why aren't people talking more about that?
You're right. I mean, look, I think that Donald Trump came onto the political scene as a presidential candidate. It's been 9 years now. And for a lot of Americans, it's been one shocking thing after another by him. And to some extent, I think that people get used to or desensitized to all of the different ways that he is unsettling democracy and challenging democracy and human rights and civil rights and so forth. But when you talk about mass deportation, yeah, it's a big deal. You're talking about stripping away people's rights, about imposing harsh human costs on families. Tom Holman, who has often been hateful in his language and his rhetoric. You know, I remember several years ago when Donald Trump first came into office, I was in a meeting with Republicans and Democrats with Tom Holman, and he was talking about their plan and what they were going to do. And of course, at that time, they didn't talk about family separation, but you could tell that there was a reason that he was doing it. And it is about skin color. It is about targeting certain populations. And I asked him at one point, because we're talking about the border in Texas and Arizona and California, they were talking about undocumented immigrants. And I asked him, well, are you also going to carry out these raids in places like Boston? And he looked at me incredulously, like, you know, why would we do that? You know, as if the only undocumented folks are brown-skinned folks who are in South Texas somewhere. And so this is very much in keeping with Donald Trump's racism and also, you know, these folks who are essentially yes men and women to Donald Trump, people like Stephen Miller, who are dangerous for the country.
But there are many people, Mexican-Americans in South Texas, who support Donald Trump, thinking that that this rhetoric of mass deportation doesn't apply to them. That they are somehow, because they are they are MAGA, they got a MAGA flag on their truck, that they're exempt.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're foolishly or naively thinking that. And even if they aren't personally roped into it, there's a chance that a parent or a cousin or a sibling, a godchild, that somebody will be. And I think some folks think that all of that vitriol and that vileness and all of it is never going to come their way. And I think that's just foolish on their part. But also, I mean, look, this man, he gave, in you know, this Madison Square Garden rally, this huge rally, it's supposed to be his closing argument for the election. And he gives time to this guy who's talking about Latinos, you know, like making all these babies and calling Puerto Rico a garbage place and all that. I mean, that's what these guys think of Hispanics. That's what they think of Hispanics, and you're going to go support this guy. You know, I mean, at some point, you should have some self-respect for yourself and the community that you're part of.
And recognize this could be an existential threat to you and your family. Is that on the table?
Yeah, dangerous. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's absolutely dangerous.
San Antonio Congressman Joaquin Castro, thanks for calling in and joining us this afternoon. We appreciate your input on the reaction to yesterday's Donald Trump rally at Madison Square Garden. We're going to let you go. Thank you so much. When we come back from the break, we're going to be talking about oligarchy in America. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Typically, when we hear about oligarchs, it's in the context of Russia, those ultra-wealthy men who serve at the pleasure of Russian dictator Putin. But we have American oligarchs, and they don't have to answer to anyone. Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Michael Bloomberg, Bill Gates, there are many more who are not household names. The threat of an oligarchy taking over democracy is as old as democracy itself. We were warned about this by the ancient Greeks. And we're joined by Jeffrey A. Winters. He's a political scientist at Northwestern University, one of the foremost scholars on oligarchies. He literally wrote the book, Oligarchy, on this, which is a highly influential as people discuss the role of wealth in politics. And Jeffrey Winters, welcome to The Source.
David, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, you know, we can make this discussion as topical and political as you want, or we can just stick to the academic part of things, because I do like the academic side of this discussion because, you know, once I started reading about it, the politics made sense. But I have seen it in the sort of academic part of it with, you know, partisan politics left out. You know, it does kind of give it more credibility. So we can do whatever you feel comfortable with about talking about oligarchy. But how do you see the oligarchy in America right now?
Well, I think it's great that you started with the question, what word are we even using, right? So in the U.S., the use of the word oligarch is increasing quite a lot, but it's still predominantly comfortably used by people to talk about Russian oligarchs, Ukrainian oligarchs, and so on. In fact, I teach a course at Northwestern University. It's called Oligarchs and Elites, and it's very interesting that on the very first day I taught the course, and that's about 15 or 20 years ago, a student said on the very first day, Russia has oligarchs, the United States has rich people. And it was fascinating that the student would say that, because the meaning of oligarch, going all the way back to ancient Greece, was people who are empowered by wealth, people who use wealth in politics, people who influence politics and outcomes by using what we call a power resource. That is a resource that's available to sway outcomes, to determine who candidates are, to set the agenda. And if I could make one more reference to that course, it's very interesting that, about 10 years ago, there was a big change. That is, when the course originally started, a lot of Northwestern students, it was a bit of a challenge to get them to wrap their minds around the idea that the United States has both oligarchy and democracy blended together. And after Citizens United and after Occupy Wall Street, it's very interesting that in the class, the challenge for me in the last, I would say, 7 to 10 years has been to convince any student that there's democracy in America. The view now is that pretty much everything that matters is determined by very, very big, concentrated, powerful money. And so it's interesting to start out with that question, do we actually have oligarchs in the United States? And my simple answer would be yes, if we understand that to be an oligarch describes a power position. It's a position of power, that's all. What you do with that power is up to you. You can support any number of things. But it describes people who have way more power than the average citizen. And that raises the question, in a democracy that is supposed to be about power sharing, an equal power sharing, one person, one vote, we believe in that, right? And we'd be upset if we had one person, a million votes versus one person, one vote. And yet, when we look at the power of wealth and how wealth is shapes our political system, we in fact have the equivalent of something which is more like one person, a million votes. So I'd say starting with the very term is a good idea.
When you have someone like Jeff Bezos, who owns the Washington Post, and he doesn't want the Washington Post whose slogan is Democracy Dies in Darkness, to endorse anyone in the presidential election. And so he kills their endorsement of Kamala Harris. I mean, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, so that's most oligarchs engage in something I call wealth defense. Wealth defense basically means if you have a massive fortune, it tends to concentrate your attention. You don't want your fortune redistributed. You don't want your fortune damaged. And so politically, what you're thinking about is, how do I maintain my wealth? How do I make sure that my wealth isn't redistributed through something like progressive taxation? How do I make sure that Congress is not regulating my industry so that my profits go down? All these things. So Jeff Bezos, who happens to own a major media outlet, he intervened directly against his own editorial board. The editorial board had already drafted its endorsement of Kamala Harris. And by the way, that is normal for editorial boards to do that across the American media. They've been doing it for more than a century. And the idea is that the reporters who are just putting up the news, they are, quote unquote, objective. But editorial boards have always had a slant, that is, a position they take, priorities that they support. And so the editorial board of The Washington Post had decided Kamala Harris was the candidate to support, and they were going to say, the draft has circulated, they were going to say that Donald Trump is dangerous for various reasons. Jeff Bezos jumped in and shut it down. Why did he do that? Well, he's an oligarch, and he's engaging in wealth defense. His concern is that if his media outlet that he owns supports Kamala Harris, he is going to have trouble. Well, that's an argument against having oligarchs own media, for one thing. But if we look at Elon Musk, Elon Musk is a different kind of oligarch. He's decided that he's not playing defense. He's actually playing offense. And in his case, he also has all kinds of money at stake with SpaceX, with Skylink, with Tesla cars, all kinds of potential regulation, potential loss of profit. And he's decided to back Donald Trump directly with his money. And he's given, by last count, more than $100 million to a super PAC that's supporting Donald Trump. So those are two cases of massive empowered people who are empowered by a wealth who are acting in political ways as oligarchs for wealth defense.
So you write in your book, Oligarchy, that there are different types of oligarchs, like warring, ruling, sultanistic, and civil. Tell me about sultanistic so we can let people know what that means.
Yeah, so what I try to do in the Oligarchy book is I try to say from the beginning, basically, of civilization forward, what kinds of governments have we had where oligarchs have been predominant? And the key question that separates different kinds of oligarchies throughout history are, first of all, are oligarchs themselves armed? And throughout most of history, oligarchs have actually been directly armed. They've been either knights in feudal, medieval and feudal Europe, or they have militias that they raise themselves. So if oligarchs are armed, they are what I call warring oligarchs. Other oligarchs have joined together into groups, small groups who run a city-state or run a government. And one of the problems they face is if they're armed,
they tend to kill each other. This is not good. So they partially disarm, but they raise forces jointly to protect their wealth. So it's a different kind of arrangement. And when a sultanistic oligarch is a different kind where all of the oligarchs in the system are disarmed, but one oligarch, a Putin-like figure or a dictator, is the one who is armed, and the role of that oligarch is to protect all the other oligarchs. And then finally, we have what the United States falls into, which is what I call a civil oligarchy, which is all property and all wealth are actually defended by our laws and by our police forces and by our military. All of our oligarchs are disarmed. And also, and this is an interesting part, they don't have to be in office directly themselves. So all the other oligarchies that I mentioned throughout history, oligarchs had to be directly ruling. They had to be in power, whether it was senators of Rome or a sultanistic oligarch. They had to rule directly. In the United States, they can rule directly, but they don't have to. They can do it by proxy, by using their wealth power to shape who the candidates are and to make sure candidates that are friendly to their goals and interests are the ones who prevail. And so oligarchy is supported that way. So those are the different kinds of oligarchies that we've seen throughout history.
And in the United States, not just purchasing and funding campaigns for politicians, but also corrupting the courts, as we've seen with the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yeah, so it's, you know, the agenda is not narrow, and the ways that money has influence is not limited just to elections. So what are the things that oligarchs really care about? They care, first of all, about not having redistribution. So they, you know, in the United States, we have what's called a progressive income tax system, right? So taxes you pay on items you buy, that's called regressive taxation because everyone has to pay the same rate. And it turns out that rate is a bigger burden for people who don't have money versus people who have a lot of money. But income taxes can be progressive, meaning the more money you have, the more you have to pay. And that progressive income tax has been in place in the United States for more than a century. And oligarchs don't like the idea that the tax system takes money from them at a higher rate and redistributes it to others in society for education, opportunities to pull themselves up, bring them up out of poverty, whatever it may be. They don't want that to happen. And so what they do is they fight against the progressive tax system. So the Supreme Court has intervened a number of times on behalf of oligarchs, first of all, to even block the income tax altogether, calling it a communistic plot, believe it or not. And courts throughout the system are supported by oligarchs who have think tanks, who help shape who the judges are going to be, because what the courts do and decide is very important for the outcomes for oligarchs.
We're taking a break. We're going to continue our conversation about oligarchy in general and also in the United States and how it's on the ballot. Our phone lines are open. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. What do you think about the influence of the most wealthy individuals in America on this election, how they are playing such a major role, probably like we've never seen before. We're taking a break and we'll be right back. The Source continues.
This program is recorded from an earlier live broadcast.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about oligarchy. We're joined by one of the experts on it. He literally wrote the book, Oligarchy, Jeffrey A. Winters. He's a political scientist at Northwestern University. Now, when you were talking about how these oligarchs like to take over media and run media, I was thinking about, it reminded me of the film Network, 1976, and how Ned Beatty is dressing down, a Peter Finch as Howard Beale and yelling at him, giving him that you have messed with forces beyond your comprehension speech, where he's saying that corporations are beyond the reach of nations, and they have taken on a whole new status that he doesn't understand. And do the oligarchs, do they see themselves as beyond national borders?
Well, one of the reasons oligarchs see themselves as beyond national borders, you're right, is that they have global mobility in a way that average citizens don't. So let me give you two examples of how that plays out. The first one is, when I was talking about taxation a moment ago, how is it that oligarchs fight redistribution through progressive taxation? Well, they do it in two ways. First, they fight in the open battle in Congress, fighting over tax brackets, reducing tax levels for themselves, reducing the number of tax brackets. That's the first round of the fight. But they're not happy with the outcome, no matter what the tax rate is. And so the second round is going offshore with their money. By going offshore, I mean that starting especially in the 1950s and 1960s, and it accelerated after that, oligarchs began to park a lot of their money in what are called tax havens, offshore locations where they can set up trusts and other kinds of accounts, and they put their money offshore, and the IRS can't see it, can't tax it, and the result is that these oligarchs are able to enjoy a tremendous amount of wealth accumulation and pay lower taxes in the end than average citizens pay. So that's the first example, using tax havens and using the global geography and the fact that the IRS is very encumbered in being able to get information about these secrecy jurisdictions where we don't know who owns what. We have paper corporations. People may remember the Panama Papers and other kinds of things that blew up in the press. There are trillions, literally trillions of dollars in what is called the offshore world. So that's number one, going abroad. The second one is corporations themselves, not just oligarchs, but corporations have moved around the world and moved their resources and moved where their headquarters are to places that are going to tax them at a much lower rate than the United States. And again, the difficulty is that a lot of this is officially legal, even though it has two effects in the U.S. One, it drains our treasury, but it shifts the burden on to people who are less able to pay. And then that just creates anger toward the IRS and the U.S. Budget system, so that we want to cut programs that we could otherwise fund if oligarchs and corporations were not using the world geography to their advantage. And so this is a real tough problem, but it's another example of what wealth power is able to achieve.
But back to Elon Musk, and really quickly, we know now that he has been in conversations with Putin and other high-ranking people in the Kremlin discussing technology using Starlink, whether or not for advantage in the war in Ukraine and also over Taiwan. Elon Musk is involved in the American space program, highly sensitive information about our space defense. And maybe we have some space offensive capabilities. We don't know about that. But, you know, how comfortable should we be about this one individual who seems to have no regard for law and order and talking to Putin about these sensitive items?
Yeah, this is extraordinary because no one elected Elon Musk. Elon Musk is not he's not beholden to anyone in the United States. And yet, because he has
engagement with NASA, because he has engagement with the Defense Department, because his technologies are so vital for things like the war between Russia and Ukraine, and whether he gives Ukraine access to Starlink and his satellite system. This means that we have basically a rogue foreign policy player who is having conversations that our Congress, our Senate, our administration are not aware of. And part of the question in a democracy is it okay for powerful actors like this to be operating in this way? First of all, we haven't delegated any power to him, and we don't know what Elon Musk's agenda is exactly. Is his agenda beneficial to the United States and its interests, or is it beneficial to Elon Musk? Well, this question doesn't arise for the average citizen because we can't engage in foreign policy in this way, but this powerful actor can. And that means that if we are a democracy, we need to think about how it is that we restrict and control the behavior of actors like this, because it can get us into a lot of trouble.
Let's go to a caller, Samir. Samir, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you for having me. Great conversation. Your panelist has touched on quite a bit, and I wanted to get his opinion on what I call like the original oligarchs of America, which are the kings of capital, going back to Rockefeller, Carnegie, Mellon, Vanderbilt, all those guys. J.P. Morgan basically bailed America out after the Civil War when we were broke, and Mellons and Rockefellers helped create the national parks. So I feel like back then the oligarchs had a more sense of a civic duty towards America. And is it maybe globalization and some of the stuff that you touched base on, tax avoidance, offshoring, that has kind of changed that persona of what an oligarch used to be? Like, now I'm going pretty far back, but just kind of get your opinion on how they've changed over like the 100 years or so.
Thanks for the question, Samir.
Yeah, Samir, thank you very much. So first of all, if you'll allow me, I'll actually take who our oligarchs are back even further. When the Constitution was written, it was written by the wealthiest people in the United States, and they were also oligarchs. And they wrote our Constitution in a way that made sure that the people's voice would be limited and that oligarchs would be protected. We don't have time to go into how that was done. I'm writing a new book called Domination Through Democracy, Why Oligarchs Win, and I expect that to come out next year.
Right. So the Articles of Confederation were helping. There's too much democracy there. People were voting to lower their state-printed currency in order so they could pay off their debts that they had accumulated during the Revolution, and they needed to have an emergency constitutional convention to kind of weaken democracy.
You're unbelievably informed. most people don't know that story, but that is that is exactly what happened. In fact, when all of the delegates met in Philadelphia in 1787, they disagreed about many things, slavery, you name it. But one of the things they all said and agreed on was that there was an excess of democracy in the United States, and it had to be limited and tamped down. And so they created a more pyramidal system, including a Senate, which they wanted people to have. Many people in the delegations wanted the senators to have a position for life, and it had to be only open to the very wealthy, a Supreme Court, and a presidency. All of this was done because the democratic process in the United States during the 1780s was threatening the wealthy. Now, if we fast forward to the people Samir was raising, and he's basically talking about the philanthropic side. And so remember a moment ago I said, well, if you have an enormous amount of money, you can do all kinds of things. Some of what you do is defending your wealth itself. But you also have the option of using your money to invest in society in different ways and create good things. That's possible, but here's what's interesting about that. The first part of the battle is to make sure that government and taxation and progressive taxation can't take your money and do things like build parks. and decide where the people want to put parks as opposed to where oligarchs want to put parks. So it's a control domination thing, even when they spend their money for us. Point number one, they spend it on things they want to spend it on. And point number two, they could have actually given up the money if they actually paid the taxes they were supposed to pay. And then we could decide what we would do with that money and how to invest it in our society for the greater good of all. So it's a power play, actually, ultimately, to be a philanthropist. I'm glad people do philanthropy, but everyone who does philanthropy first engages what I call the wealth defense industry. That's thousands and thousands of lawyers and accountants in an industry, in a multi-billion dollar industry, whose sole job is to make sure oligarchs don't pay taxes. That would be my comment on that.
Got to take a break. Got some more callers on the board. I'll get you on the air when we come back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, talking about oligarchy with Jeffrey Winters, author of the book Oligarchy. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about oligarchy with Jeffrey A. Winters, political scientist at Northwestern University and a foremost scholar on oligarchy. Let's go to a caller. We have Caroline. Caroline, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. I'm David Martin Davies. Thank you again for your timely, urgent, and universal, clearly with such clarity, presenting this on oligarchy. I want to bring up initially that there is oligarchy of several levels and types that Dr. Winters is presenting here in San Antonio, all the way to international levels. And you've done such a wonderful job in your introduction of bringing in some of them, and in other programming you've done on The Source. I also want to thank Dr. Winters for your long-term work in doing this, your vocation on oligarchy throughout the ages and currently, and the importance of disseminating this, educating everyone about it with breadth and depth.
All right, Caroline, thank you so much for that call. So, Jeffrey Winters, what do you think the level of awareness that people have? I mean, everyone knows the name Elon Musk, I pretty much expect, or Jeff Bezos, or Bloomberg, Bill Gates. I mean, do they know that these are people who have so much influence that there's something is broken?
Yeah, well, first of all, Caroline, thank you for those very positive and supportive comments for this kind of work. I do think it's important, and I think awareness is vital. Maybe David, it's possible to go back to when it comes to awareness, maybe we need to talk again about even the words we use and the words that are predominant in our media. So, for example, although we occasionally hear the word oligarch, the far more common word we hear is mega donors. Headline after headline about this mega donor is giving this amount of money to this candidate. Nikki Haley, can she get a mega donor to back her? The mega donors are running away from Joe Biden, and therefore he needs to end his presidency. There's this constant patter in our media calling these people mega donors. So let's be clear, first of all, that they are not donating. This is not donation. Donation is something you do without expectation of something in return. Donation is an altruistic thing. This is an expression of power. And so one of the reasons I think that American the American population isn't nearly as aware of the distorting and anti-democratic role of money in politics is partly because our media are, first of all, corporate owned, and oligarchs don't like to be called oligarchs, even though, by the way, oligarch is a far more neutral term historically than mega donor, which is a term they like to be called. So awareness is about understanding that your democracy is deeply distorted. When people say democracy is rigged, they think of things like, you know, voting abnormalities and so on. The rigging is far, far more deep, to the point where one person, one vote has been essentially canceled. And there's a lot of anger and frustration out there about how democracy is not responsive to the average citizen. But a lot of people don't necessarily know the details of how it works. And let me mention just one thing that we really should pay attention to. And that's something we're all familiar with: primaries. Primaries are what the parties do to determine who their candidates are going to be. And those happen before the general election. But there's something that happens before the primary when citizens get to vote. And that's called the wealth primary. And the wealth primary is when someone who wants to be in the primary has to run around to very wealthy, early, big money donors and try to become viable. And that means that we allow oligarchs to decide who we get to choose. And that's the most important thing they do politically. Just because you give money to somebody doesn't mean they're necessarily going to win. But people who want to run, who get no money because oligarchs aren't interested in their politics, those people are not viable at all. So the gatekeeping that the ultra wealthy do especially has to do with the wealth primary, where you can't even get started in American politics for the most part, unless you're brilliantly good at crowdsourcing, which very, very few people have been able to do. Everybody runs around and says, what oligarch can I get to back me? And automatically that greatly decreases the agenda. And with what consequence?
Yeah.
Here's the kicker. The consequence is that inequality in America has absolutely exploded. And that's because oligarchy in the United States is so powerful. Let me just give you one example, and I'll be brief. There was a study done by the RAND Corporation, which is not a left-wing organization. RAND did a study, and they asked a simple question. If we take inequality in 1975 and just lock it in and project it forward to about 2020, what would be the median income of the average citizen? And the answer was this: the actual median income in 2018 was $50,000. It would have been $92,000 if 1975 inequality was still in place. $50 trillion moved upward from the average citizen to the less than 1% at the top. That's what oligarchs do. That's why inequality is so extreme in the United States today.
I'm going to go to Edward on the phones. And Edward, we're short on time, but I'm getting you on the air. Go ahead.
I realize that, but the last caller and that extemporaneous speaking just dovetailed into what I want to say. My initial comment or question was, when has this never been true? When has this not been true? And I'm blanking on your name,
Winters,
to be quick. Related that it's been a feature of the United States since literally the structural founding of the Constitution. It ain't going away. And on that note, I want to push back a little bit on this idea, the previous caller, as well as yourself, David, that oligarchy's on the ballot. Who's running against it? Kamala's part of the system, guys. So.
All right. Well, Edward, thank you so much. But Democrats since Obama, they've pioneered small donations, and it has they are outraising pretty much the Republicans by using small donations. But yes, I understand your point. Go ahead, Professor Winters.
David, I'm going to side with Edward on this one, which is the Democrats and the Republicans both are funded by oligarchs overwhelmingly. Sure. Obama started out with small donations. That actually got him on the agenda versus Hillary Clinton, who was the anointed one. And then he became president because of massive big donations from big players. So you can't win in American politics today without massive, massive
support.
Okay,
so let me push back. But we have Elon Musk saying that he's going to be he's not going to be the secretary because he's not going to go through a Senate confirmation hearing, but he's going to be in charge of government efficiency and slashing programs. And do you really want someone who receives billions and billions of dollars in government contracts in charge of government efficiency? I mean, he is on the ballot.
Yeah, that's a good counterpoint. So the parties have not necessarily been absolutely equal, but that incredible concentration of wealth upward over the last 50 years has occurred under both Democratic and Republican administrations. So are there variations? Yes, but the big picture is fundamentally oligarchs fund our system. Edward's point, when has it not been the case? Let me just point out, you can't completely take power out of money. Money is power, no doubt about that. But we can open the floodgate of that power, as we did with Citizens United through the Supreme Court, or we can try to limit it. That's one thing. So how effective oligarchs can be, that's up to us through legislation. And number two, during the earlier decades of the 20th century, during the New Deal, during the Roosevelt FDR period, actually oligarchs were on the defensive. Far more progressive taxation, far more redistribution downward to the people. So it matters what the politics are. You're quite right. It's not something you can completely get rid of. But the question is the valve wide open, or are we actually putting controls in place? We are in an era, thanks to Citizens United and other decisions, for example, treating corporations as persons that have First Amendment rights, which is absolutely nutty. Corporations are made up of persons who already have First Amendment rights. Why give a corporation, which is nothing real, why give it rights as well? There's all kinds of decisions that have been made where concentrated wealth and power are augmented. And we're in a period of what I call in-your-face oligarchy. Where it's unprecedented how much and how boldly and how blatantly money is being used today.
Jeffrey A. Winters is a political scientist at Northwestern University, one of the foremost scholars on oligarchies. His book, Oligarchy, is highly influential. He is frequently used as an example. His work is used to highlight what is happening with wealth and politics in America. And Dr. Winters, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate this.
Such a pleasure. Thank you.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.